Cats are just a waste of time. I'm skipping through them, I'd rather listen and change my mind. Wes and Nick always help me through my daily grind. Your favorite guys, your favorite lines, change my mind. I swear these other podcasts are just a waste of time. I'm skipping through them, I'd rather listen and change my mind. Wes and Nick always help me through my daily grind. Your favorite guys, your favorite lines, change my mind.
Yeah. And welcome back to a very special edition of the Change My Mind podcast.
I won't change my mind because I don't have to, because I'm an American.
Yes, you are. And I am Wesley Sykes. And through the other side of the ether is the Professor X to my Magneto. It's Mr. Nicholas J. Eskfryer, mutant for hire.
Yeah, we got a really, really special episode, Wes. I'm very excited. As we mentioned last time we convened, this is an audio-only episode, mm-hmm. No stream, because we tend to do that whenever we do interviews. So we got one planned for everybody today, and I am very excited for you to introduce the couple that we have on.
Yes, absolutely. Returning guest, Eric and Julia Leewalder, creators of the original X-Men, the animated series, of course, authors of the books, the X-Men, the art and making of the animated series, and previously on X-Men, the making of an animated series, to discuss X-Men 97, the reboot, the sequel, a little bit of both there.
Yeah, kind of, they call it an extension.
They call it season six.
Yeah.
Which we love that.
But. Kind yes, of, that's... you know, a few weeks later, it's like, yeah, it's like the next episode.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much. Thanks for coming back on our next episode here. It's nice to have you back. First and foremost, just, you know, what has been your impression of the show? Six episodes in, you know, as consulting producers on it. I'm sure you've seen everything front and back already. But as it's come out in real time, what's been the reception like?
It's been astonishing to see the X-Men 97. And then to see the reaction and response to people, I think it's across the board. There's been nothing but love and affection for the new series, and I'll as the official old lady here in the world of X-Men podcasting and what have you, it means so much to me because I have been a fan of things myself from a very young age that I've still been a fan of as I've gotten older. So everyone who was an original X-Men, the animated series fan, or whenever you found it, if X-Men, the animated series, you've had that many years to hold it inside of you and to have that in your heart. And then X-Men 97 comes along and you are invited and allowed and welcomed back into that world with all the affection and love that can be there. The found family has found itself again.
Yeah. And it was very, I had great sympathy for the people doing it because, you know, we've been out here, we both moved out here to the Hollywood to be part of all this. And because we were geeks ourselves, we love our shows. I mean, when we were little, the initial Star Trek was what, you know, hooked us, and, you know, we love it to this day. So that was almost 60 years ago.
Shush.
And that's how long stuff stays with people. But then the people, 9 out of 10 times when people do a spinoff or a new version of something, it isn't very satisfying for the original fans. It's a really hard thing, mm-hmm. tightrope to walk, to have something that respects the original and has a little bit of a fresh voice of its own. And the stories are still good and you still love the characters and you haven't distanced the people that fell in love with the original back when they were younger. It's such a hard thing to do. So we had the easy spot as being consultants. All these people in their 30s spent 3 years cranking, making this new show. And they're already mostly done making the second season. Just so you know, it's coming along. They already have it all laid out.
Oh, wow. That's great.
And it's already been written and it's in animation. So, nice. So that's, they've done this amazing job. And then we all were waiting to see, you know, how are people going to react? Because you can't just repeat stuff. You don't know if the new one's going to hook in the way the old one hooked in, for the old viewers or a new set of viewers. And we watched it when there was a premiere here a week before it started streaming, and there's a theater full of people watching, and we could just feel them all getting into it more and more and more and more, you know, each episode more than the one before it. So we just knew by the end of that night that, oh, this is going to work. And that was so happy.
Again, to be the official little old lady here, we both, when we came out, when we each met each other out here, because I came from Texas, you came from Tennessee, and Star Trek, the original Star Trek. And we said, oh, you know Star Trek? You know, because the internet didn't exist. If you knew something, you had to go out and buy the paperback books with the episodes in them. So having grown up with the original Star Trek, and then was it 20 years later when the first Star Trek movie came out, which was great eye candy, but and as a fan, that was all there was. It's like, oh my God. But Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, it's like 20 years later, Space Seed, they earned it. They earned that as a fan, for me being a fan. And now I feel the same way about X-Men 97. What they're doing, they've earned it. They've earned it based on what the original series was and the 60 years worth of books they have to draw on now.
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, there's still so much that has been untouched when it comes to X-Men. It's amazing. I mean, and this is why, you know, what's so special about this too is like we kind of talked about it beforehand. This is a generation of fans that like kind of don't know just how good the X-Men are. I mean, like these kids that are, you know, 15 years younger than Wes and I, it's like the Avengers this, Avengers that. And I no disrespect to the Avengers, but it's like, you guys ain't seen nothing yet when it comes to it. Now you're getting a taste of it now. And if you're going back and watching the work you two originally did, they're getting the full effect. And in the course of all this too, what's been kind of crazy for me to see is the different reactions that we're getting. And I'm curious for you too as well. You know, I know like Mina Kimes is someone who you two retweet a lot, because obviously we see her backdrop all the time. But then the craziest one for me has to have been LeBron tweeting about the show and go, you know, getting to watch everything. Was that the wildest one for you two, or is there another one?
It's
I'm interrupting. I think that was the most for me out of left field. Who, the GOAT in that world, watched this thing and he liked it as a little person and is now this person, and he oh my God. My goal in life is to figure out somehow to get him a couple copies of the books we have, just because, I mean, he may not know they're out there, because, you know, it's a very niche market.
We've had some of the most unusual people, you know, love the original series. Of all the things, just as a little historical footnote, I don't know if you guys remember, Mike Tyson went to jail for a couple of years.
Oh, Jesus.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm familiar, yeah.
That's Tyson. He comes out and he's in the cover of Time magazine. And there he's talking about... he's talking about getting out of jail and getting his life back and turning himself around and, you know, what life is... And he said, oh, and by the way, I just kind of hang out in my hotel room in Las Vegas and watch X-Men the Animated Series. It's my favorite show. Those characters are great. Yeah.
I'm not sure that's the kind of endorsement we need.
I didn't know that. That's a wild story, though. That's
Wow. So it's like with the LeBron thing. It's just this guy. I mean, these people that, you know, that the entire world knows and respects, and when they get a spare minute, they're watching our show. So
That has to be the ultimate compliment there. And actually, just kind of like following off of that question, you know, Nick and I were children of the 90s, like everyone else, fan of the original X-Men, the animated series. But I think this is also an introduction, like kind of Nick was mentioning earlier, to a whole new crop of fans. So I'm wondering, you know, and they deal with, the show deals with, obviously, like in the original series, complex ideas. You know, there's different layers to everything where I think it can appeal to different audiences. But was there any discussion about who a target audience is for this X-Men 97 show?
Well, that's interesting. And because the world has changed 30 years later, when you were tasked, and I just clarify, I was a writer on X-Men the Animated Series and proud consulting producer on X-Men 97. Eric and Mark Edens were the two folks on the writing side of things who crafted the stories in terms of making the series go. I'll take credit, but I want to make sure they get it. But back then, it was very specific marching orders for a Saturday morning animated kids show, boys action adventure. Yeah. And here and now, and that's because it was on Fox Kids, which was a brand new startup network.
Mm-hmm.
Now with Disney Plus, I don't mean they've aged it up, but I mean they have greater license than we ever did.
There were all sorts of
Cyclops said the word "damn." I heard him.
Yeah, I mean, just it was it's a weird middle ground. Most of the places when we were writing in the '80s and the '90s, that if you did a kid show, an X-Men was Saturday morning children's show. There was a really strict group of rules about what you could and couldn't show. I mean, our censor didn't want us to say the word kill.
Broadcast standards and practices person. Yeah. And that was a woman named Avery Coburn.
Nobody.
She deserves all the credit in the world.
There's 100 things she let us do. Oh, that. But so if it hadn't been everything but before X-Men and Batman, it would have been this in this very contained universe where you couldn't have sharp swords. You couldn't have imitable weapons. You couldn't say bad things about each other. It was a very gentle, protected world. And then Fox kind of blew that out of the water a bit because, you know, they were brand new and they were tiny and they're trying to get attention. So they pushed the envelope. The Simpsons and Married with Children were prime time, were a little more intense than their competition. And X-Men and Batman on Saturday morning were more intense than the competition. And that gave us this opportunity to make it not so much just a very controlled kids show anymore. It was still within the kids' world, and we still had some of those, you know, we couldn't let Wolverine ride a motorcycle because you would have to give him a helmet. You know, you couldn't show, if somebody were racing and blowing up cities, they'd have to have their seatbelt on. There were hundreds of.
No kidding, down to the nitty gritty like that, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
No fire. Yeah, fire was a big deal, but that kind of thing. But again, if we're going to bring that up with Fox Kids, we have to mention the person who made this happen. It was the president of Fox Kids, a woman named Margaret Lesh, and she deserves all. We wouldn't be here. X-Men wouldn't be here
because she loved the books. And for about 10 years, she tried to get the show on the air.
She worked for Marvel Productions here in LA.
And the three networks wouldn't put it on. They said it's too intense and adult and kind of inside baseball and dark, and you know, no, kids aren't going to watch this and they're not going to buy cereal watching this. So stop talking to us about it. So she gets it on, and she knows, understands, and respects the books. And the censor lady, Avery, understood, liked, and respected the books. So they understood how intense the books were in 1992. Yeah. And that was the beginning of our conversation. So, well, guys, if this is what the fans are reading in the comic books, we can't be a world away. We can't give them Super Friends if this is what they're reading in the comic books. And they all got that. They all were very adult about it and said, yes, tell adult dramatic stories. Mm-hmm. And I was, oh my God, really? Please say that again. Say that out loud. Write that down somewhere so that we can hold you to it.
Yeah.
And our main guy right under Margaret, who was her field general, Sidney Eyewater, who is this like 9-year-old boy who in his heart.
Yeah, still.
Still. And but loved quality television and storytelling, said, yes, this is, you know, I want this to be Hill Street Blues. I don't want this to be, you know, something simple-minded. I, you know, push it. And so it was an opportunity for us. I mean, the people that wrote on our show for us had written on other stuff and been frustrated. And, you know, 10 years down the line, this thing opens up. The artists, too. The artists are looking at it and said, they're going to let us draw this stuff? So everybody involved with it just saw this as this great opportunity to, like, do their best stuff and push it and not have it pulled back. And that was part of the joy. And I'm sure it came through in the work, because we were so happy to be able to do it.
Yeah, it absolutely did. And I think one of the ways that I always describe X-Men, the animated series, is like, it, as a kid, because I've obviously gone back and rewatched it on Disney Plus, which is so great to have it right there, nice and easy. But as a kid, I felt like I was watching something that was like, I'm not quite old enough to be watching this shit. Like, it feels a little too badass for me. And then still years later, I go back and watch it and it's amazing. But it's like, I see the elements of why I felt that, but you still have these restrictions that the whole team had to kind of dance around. It's really remarkable. Some of the stuff that you had to, you know, the barriers you had to jump over and that you crossed, it's stood the test of time. I mean, clearly looking at where we are now.
In a way, you've often said that, oh God, everything was under a time constraint and under a budgetary constraint. X-Men had no luxury of time, no luxury of budget, but in a way that kind of obligated all of us to think on our feet, work fast, work hard. And as a result, there wasn't a lot of time for second guessing.
Yeah.
Once that train left the station for each episode, there were dozens of people drawing and hundreds of people, thousands of people animating overseas. It was a crazy production.
Yeah. I mean, we've worked on shows where they've had much deeper budgets, and it just allows people to spend five times the amount of time rethinking it. I remember literally having, okay, here's the eighth outline for this story. Okay. I can't give you any more. Those are the only eight I can think of in my entire mind. Just pick one of them and I'll write the script. I don't care. By the, 3 months in, we're still writing this outline. And with X, there was just no time for that. It's okay, guys, sit down, give the most intense story you can about Beast or about Rogue or about whatever this one is this week. And here, hand it to the artists, hand it to the voice actors, hand it overseas. No time to rethink, no time to, we could go a different direction. Just do it. And close your eyes and cross your fingers and hope for the best. And So it was very much that. It was just, it was a blitz. And it was, and that worked out for us. I mean, it even though there was a lot of stress in hitting those deadlines, I think it made us happy and made us creatively satisfied.
Now, how about the behind the scenes process for X-Men 97, working with those younger group of writers and kind of going back? That had to be kind of cool to see a whole generation kind of be influenced and inspired and coming back and it's like, you did this in episode two. What happened here? And can we pick this up for, this new season here? Can you kind of give us some details of what that was like working with that writer's room?
It was amazing to see their encyclopedic knowledge of this. It's like
they embarrassed us.
Yeah, it was like they were biblical scholars that knew every detail. And, even though we'd written a couple books, this stuff we didn't notice or hadn't remembered, that they were very much on top of. And just to, so the proper people get the credit, this new team of writers and artists who all had to be, the showrunner, Bo, demanded that they be fans of the original series. So that was kind of cool. Mm-hmm. But we were not in on the writing of these 10 episodes. We were what they called us in as consultants. We were in what they were their first
audience.
Their first audience. So they would post a script. We'd look it over. We'd read it. We'd think, if it were my show, is there anything that we might suggest to plus this a little bit, or are there red flags here that make it not connect with our character? So they built it. We reacted, we gave some notes to it, but they, we can't take credit for the creation of this wonderful new show. We're just helping out these new guys. So it is very much, it's their show. And we are here to clap, to cheer them on and catch them if they miss something.
Everything old is new again, because when you were in charge of the original writing back in 92, there was no studio office room for anybody. So we were all, every writer was working at home or at a coffee house, writing the scripts. There was no writer's room.
That was a strange part about the way we worked. It was like 76 little movies.
Yeah.
And we decide about an episode. I'd call the writer, let's say it was Julia, or something. Here you go. This is, we're going to tell the Beast story. And then she'd work on it. I'd polish up a premise or an outline or whatever. We'd send it into everybody, to all, to Fox and Marvel and everyone for their comments. And then I'd kind of try to correlate all that. And I hand it back to her and she'd finish the script. So it's basically, the writer and I would be making a movie, but we're never a group of seven or eight people tossing out ideas and fixing each other's stories. It was always one on one. At the beginning of the season, we'd get as many writers as we could get together and say, this is the kind of thing we're going to be doing this year. And we hope all of you get an assignment, but we don't know yet. Because the budgets were tiny, but because so we didn't have any, we didn't have a budget for staff. So it was all freelance work. It was like, yeah, you okay. call up, you know, are you free? You know, are you free this month? Well, I got you a gig. And if not, okay, I got to call the next guy on my list or girl on my list. Yeah.
But you know what? You two aren't giving yourselves enough credit, because for all the work that you did for them to bring you back and like kind of get your stamp of approval on things or additional notes. I mean, that's the kind of stuff for Wes and I and other people who grew up watching the show to know that you're involved. And then Larry, too, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
That's to get your stamps of approval. That speaks volumes. But then that also means, like, what the hell when it comes to Gambit? Like, you know, you guys okay? That kind of stuff? But seriously, what an amazing death for that character.
They earned it. I mean, I don't mean that lightly. I don't mean that cavalierly. I mean, oh my goodness, the decision to tell the stories they've chosen to tell and the manner in which they tell them, and the animation and the sound and the music and the voice talent. Yes. Huh, that's what you can do when you have money and talent. And time.
Money and time. Yeah, because we talked with them about that. You know, Larry would get the animation back from overseas in our world. And we'd have like 10 days before it had to air. So he could make, if there were 32 errors that we got back, you know, things that weren't animated right or weren't what we'd, you know, we'd cut out 7 or 8 of them. We'd get them to redo a few, and 3 or 4 would still end up in the show. Because we'd have one real quick pass at fixing stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, these guys had months to get every single movement and every single is a, so Larry is just looking at them like a, you know, the little kid looking at the rich people driving by in the Rolls Royce. And they had all this time to make this beautiful. It's great to watch to see how good it is.
I'm pleased with myself that so what our role has been and a lot. So we didn't have a writer's room for what we did. And when we were invited back, we were invited on to X-Men 97. It was still the tail end of COVID. So there was still no writer's room. Well, we got to meet folks through Zoom, which is a whole different experience. We got to communicate that way.
And there's one day at the writer's room and everybody is wearing masks and they're kind of laying out, they're starting to lay out the second season. But the thing about the Gambit moment, which I just thought, I mean, think back about it. If you're the guy laying out these 10 episodes, because the first season is, and as I understand it, it was in Bo's original pitch what happened to Gambit and where it was placed, because I think it's like we had Mark Edens and I in the original called up the first day we were trying to lay out 13 stories, we called up the network and said we want to kill one of the X-Men in order to prove there's some real consequences to being an X-Men. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that fit there structurally. That was important, that if someone were to sacrifice heroically, that we do it in the first story. So everybody got, oh, this is what the show's about. Okay, mm-hmm. Cool. Well, most of the people watching the new show get it now. So they didn't have to do it in episode one, but in the arc of this first 10 stories, they were allowed to build for 5 stories to this Gambit moment. And mm-hmm. I thought that was about the perfect balance. If it was, I think episode 8 would have been too late. Episode 2 would have been too early. It let them reestablish the world and get the relationship set and build to what the real problem was for mutants, and let Gambit have this spectacular central moment in the middle of the story arc.
Amazing. It was something. I'm like he's gone. And I know superheroes, like, you know, no one's ever truly gone, but at the same time, it's like I could never ask for a better end for the guy who's the reason why I fell in love with superheroes and then the comic book medium, you know, altogether. So it's just it's a bittersweet moment, but it was like for a guy who's so underrated all the time, and I understand why, especially when you're looking at his wife, it's like, or girlfriend in X-Men the animated series, his wife in the comics, you know, I understand it, but now it's like, you know, where everybody else couldn't get it done, he did in such a like amazing way, like visually and everything.
Yeah,
I think a thing that we still each occasionally choke up when we talk about the final episode called Graduation Day in the original series, written by Jim Krieg, where Professor Xavier is mortally wounded and is saying goodbye to each of his X-Men. Mm-hmm. And I I can't quote the line, but when he speaks to Gambit, it, you know, how often does the scoundrel have to prove himself before he believes that, you know, in his own heart? And it was just like, oh my God, everything was just, but yeah, that Gambit and the decision to have him in the team in the first place back in 92, he was a new character for the comic book world at that point. Well, newish, given we're talking 30 years.
Yeah, 3 years, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, and you weren't quite sure if you could count on him. You weren't quite sure, which is unusual for a team.
Yeah, because I was so new to the X-Men when we did the show, and I would be constantly calling Larry, or I'd be faxing, this pre-internet, faxing Bob Harris at Marvel, saying, okay, well, tell me more about the backstory of this guy, you know, Beast growing up, or, you know, somebody. So what about Gambit? We're going to do a show about him. And he said, well, we don't know about half the questions you're asking. We haven't really decided yet. He's new enough. And we all just kind of smiled and shook hands and said, well, we'll keep him mysterious. We won't write it. We'll try to not write much of anything specific in. You don't write it in. We'll leave it up to the viewer's imagination. So that was a fun thing to do with him, since he was new enough. We didn't, you know, we could not say where he'd been and what he'd done and quite why he was there. And that was cool.
There's one episode, I can't remember which one, but it's early, early morning. Everyone got yanked out of bed to go into the conference room for a conversation. And Gambit comes strolling in his night clothes, and Wolverine still in his pajama goes, yeah, little late, huh, Cajun? And he goes, oh, no, Cher, a little early. It's like, oh, Gambit, what were you out doing that this is considered early for you to be coming in at this hour? Oh, naughty, naughty.
But, yeah. Well, you know, I love the way that you're talking about Gambit and kind of like the emotion that it brings up. Obviously, it was an emotional moment for my co-host Nick here. But is there a character that you guys most identify with or you know, kind of see yourselves with when you were writing?
This is sideways here, but loved writing for Beast, for Hank McCoy, because of on the original team that for the X-Men animated series. If the whole point is that the humans are afraid of the mutants, on that team, he is the only one who cannot walk down the street without folks pointing and going, oh my God, that's a mutant. Do you see him? He's blue. He's got fur. And yet he was the most, I don't mean comfortable, but he was the most at ease within the world of the X-Men with that, and continued to study, to learn, to grow. And it's, oh my God, the damaged poet. With the soul, and again, as a writer, it was always fun to write for the smartest guy in the room, because then you got to kind of pretend to show off.
Yeah.
And you had him, the original call to arms for the show was
those quotes. That was just this random thing that happened when we did the opening
two-parter,
and he's leading the team and on this thing. And we'd all worked on other action shows where there were kind of kiddie calls to act, you know, cowabunga or whatever, or, things that people would cry out before they leapt into action. And it bemused me that Beast was there and that he was going to say something. And so I just kind of kept a placeholder there. It's something like, you know, once more into the breach, old friend, some literary quote. And then when we got to just before recording, we say, wait a minute, maybe we could do that. And we were starting to write some other episodes, and the other writers were liking it, said, can I throw in a weird, obscure quote as well? I was, okay, well, let's push this up a step. And I looked up something about feet, and I got the far more obscure quote, and we just did it. We did it as a gag that of course, Beast would know this obscure poem. And everybody liked it. So we ended up doing about 30 of them.
But this is in the day before the internet. So we had to use Bartlett's book of quotations.
Yeah, it's all looking up old reference books.
Because
you couldn't just Google, you know, obscure quote about feet.
You wouldn't want to.
True. That would be funny.
This is true. Yeah. Oh man, that's amazing.
How about for yourself, Eric? Was there a character that you identified with, or that you liked writing the most?
Yeah, I had to like writing them all the same, because it was like having a big family. And if I ended up not caring about a character much, I probably wouldn't have pushed to, you know, to improve the, you know, to improve the dialogue wherever I could. So I try to get into all their heads, but the one that I think is the most satisfying, that I think ended up in more episodes than would have if somebody else had been running the show, was Xavier. And that was absolutely because, you know, I was in my mid to late 30s, and over the course of 4.5 years, we had 20 different writers writing for those 76 episodes. And I felt very much like the father guy trying to herd all these people together and keep it consistent and keeping everybody together. And so absolutely had this empathy grow with him. And he's not an easy one to write for, because he has to spout his ideals all the time. And that doesn't, I mean, we end up with a wonderful voice for him. So that helped. But I think he got more screen time because I empathized with him as being the centerpiece of this whole adventure. And so that was he worked great for me.
I love
now,
that.
Speaking of, now, so we have those two characters. We've talked about Gambit quite a bit already, and we know Storm's been having a big series. Jubilee had her really cool episode with Roberto. But then what's a question that seems to have been popping up on as the series has gone along is, why is Wolverine not getting as much action quite yet? And I'm curious for you two, because obviously you use Wolverine quite heavily, and now that you've gotten, you of course got to look at the scripts, and you know, season two is moving along and everything as well. I'm curious, like you said, they've earned a lot, and they have these writers. When you started to see how they were using Wolverine, were you at all surprised that he wasn't going to be as front and center as, you know, most would probably try to make him be?
If you go back to the original series versus, say, X-Men Evolution or Wolverine and the X-Men, he was not front and center. He's such a memorable character, and he's everybody's favorite id, because, you know, I can just pop out my claws and kill you, and then I'm not going to die. I mean, that's just, oh, that's good Lord, talk about, you know, wish fulfillment. But I think part of the genius of the character is to use him as part of the team. And I think that's what they're really making an effort to do now. And by the way, episode 5, if we can for a moment, you got your Logan, you got your Jean Grey, you have a thing happen.
Yeah.
That I'm watching this going, this could be an entire season story right here. And it's just the first 5 minutes of one episode in the middle of season one. Yeah. Oh my goodness, you know. But they earned that too, and they earned his reaction. And I think they're using him in the same way that he was used in the animated series. He's just such a big character in his own right that you don't realize that. Yeah,
I think part of it, you know, we're looking at it. We noticed that, because I literally had an issue early on. In, let's say, over the first two seasons I think it balanced out as the show went along. But early on, the scripts were coming in Wolverine heavy, and it was because the writers were all excited, and he was just the coolest guy to write. I mean, it's like having Dirty Harry there and giving him lines and having him leap into the middle of problems and just blow the scene up. And it was. And I had probably even had notes to the writer saying, guys, try to find, you know, try to share the wealth here. We'd get onto things like the Phoenix and Dark Phoenix. And there'd be places where other characters were really coming to the fore. Or if we just had a Beast episode or a Cyclops episode. But, you know, week in and week out, you're right, Wolverine had the bit largest presence in our show. I think it's a case of two things. One of them is they used as a centerpiece for this arc, or a real jumping off point, Scott and Jean and Madeline Pryor and Cable, you know, the baby, and as a way to get into the world. And that just in and of itself made it more Cyclops and Jean heavy. I mean, Wolverine's there and Wolverine's reacting and he's the third wheel, but the stories I think by the nature of the starting point that they chose tended to be a little more Cyclops heavy. And I think it comes down to, you know, every showrunner is going to have a fascination. And I think the new showrunner has more of a fascination with Cyclops. And I think he really, and looking back, I think we underdeveloped in our show. I think we could have done more with Cyclops. I think we could have done a little more with Storm and a little more with Jubilee. I think we got Beast and we got Rogue and we got Gambit and we got Wolverine and Xavier and Magneto. I think my proudest thing is building and developing their relationship. Mm-hmm. But I think there were three or four characters that if we'd done another season, we would have sat down and said, okay, we need to spend more time with Cyclops and Jubilee and Storm, because I think they were slightly underrepresented. And that may have been in the back of their minds when they built this first story arc, but you'll see more of Wolverine. It's been Jean and Cyclops heavy because of the Madeline Pryor thing, I think, from the start.
Yeah, and you mentioned that whole love triangle or square. I'm not sure how you would call it, right? Or what type of shape it would take. But when they're discussing handing off the baby, right? Nate Summers, that part really hit home to me as a first time father, you know, and it's weird to have an animated show kind of grab hold of your emotions like that.
Yeah.
But that was a big moment for me. I know Nick mentioned the attack on Genosha with Gambit's death being a big one, but when you're receiving these scripts and you're seeing them, you know, maybe through the first six episodes, or we don't want any spoilers or anything, but was there a moment that really jumped out at you? Like, oh my God, they're doing this, or kind of like a WTF type moment?
Putting a pin in that.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to the original series, when you were tapped to develop, create X-Men, whatever, you were given 13 episodes. That's as far as the folks above Margaret Lesh thought it was going to last. They were expecting it to crash and burn. So you had 13 episodes. And that's a hit. And okay, we're going to do 13 more episodes. So, and then after that, it was, we've got 3.5 seasons to go. So there was never a 5-season arc to the whole show, because the show was never, no one working on the show was given that kind of, oh, you're going to get 65 episodes from the beginning. And you've said that when it came time to start season 2, because season 1 had ended with Jean and Scott, you know, pledging devotion and proposing and going to live happily ever after, thinking, oh, you know, season 2, let's have her pregnant with the first double mutant baby, you know.
we had pitched that. Yeah. Mark and I were starting to write that for season 2, and we got a note back from
many people.
Everybody, from Marvel, from Fox. Hold it. And in Marvel's case, it was, this is a cool idea, but we're thinking about this for something down, you know, a couple of years from now in the mm-hmm. book. So please hold off on this. Some of our colleagues, Fox and Graz and everywhere, say, now, wait a minute. You know, our core audience is 11-year-old boys. Do you really want Jean, you know, running around battling supervillains with a huge baby bump in her spandex? And we thought, cool, you know, because, you know, we'd all just had babies, and sure, we thought it was, you know, it'd be fine. But just so you know, that had existed as a possibility.
So when they opened X-Men 97 with pregnancy, it's like, oh my God,
it was like, the one, it was the avenue we weren't allowed to go down, and they grabbed it somehow. And the people doing the books had grabbed it, obviously, years after we suggested it as an idea. But as far as amazing moments in the new series, obviously the two you suggest are the two biggest ones. Wolverine kissing Jean.
Mm-hmm. No, Jean kissing Wolverine. Let's be straight about that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Good point. Logan. Good point. Good point. Logan. Yeah. Logan would never presumed. they got the emotional intensity of what we were trying to do, and they really built on people knowing the original episodes. I mean, I don't know if Julia told you, but the people at Marvel said that at Disney Plus, Viewership of the old of our old show has gone up 540%.
Percent.
No, yeah, yeah, yeah. Five and a half times in anticipation of the new show. Mm-hmm. Everybody's binging the old show to catch up because they maybe they noticed the people doing the new show are kind of, if not counting on you knowing the old show, making it a much richer experience if you do know the old show, all the, mm-hmm. the references inside it and all. So that we just think that's the coolest thing in the world, that it's like if you, it, we have a similar thing, success. The most recent Star Trek series we enjoyed very much. I forget what's
Brave New Worlds.
Brave New Worlds.
I love that one.
And, you know, here we are. We were little kids when the original came out and we fell in love with the original and the kind of the tone and the vision of the original. And we thought, okay, this new one, Jesus, what is it? Yeah, 55 years later, has caught that better than any than the dozen attempts in between, we thought. So it's just the fact that somehow the people making that this new show were steeped in the first one, and we appreciate that so much.
I can tell you one thing I contributed that didn't make the cut was, so all the drama, oh my god, giving birth to the baby, I thought, well, what if you have a moment back at the mansion when before Wolverine is made aware of what horrible thing has happened to the baby, and him come down the hallway with a toy car to say, tell Cyclops I made him a convertible, you know. That's like real inside baseball right there.
Yeah,
we would have appreciated that though. But now with them doing that, you know, now that we're talking about it with Madeline Pryor, it's you know, as they did in the comics, they just call so much into question. And now with your show too, it's like, now I kind of want to go back, and it's like, when was this Madeline Pryor? When was it Jean? I have no clue. It's, you know, obviously because Sinister has been, you know, doing stuff behind the scenes as he's one to do even to this day in the comics. At the end of, I think it was episode 6 where we see a little bit of more of him. We saw him earlier in the series as well because of stuff with Morph. And I'm curious, when it comes to, obviously Sinister's not new to the series, but you obviously over the 5 seasons you two brought in tons of characters from the X-Men comics. But what I think you did so well was you were able to like focus on some, sprinkle in different ones, see them a little bit here and there. Was there not a formula, but was there like a thought process or just a procedure that you went through when it came to like introducing new characters, not new characters in general, new characters from the comics, and trying to be as effective as possible to both respect people who read the comics, but then also people who maybe aren't even aware of certain characters, like a Lady Deathstrike that's in the comics.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The thing with Morph from the original series, and he was supposed to stay dead. That was the point of the 13 episodes, that in the world of the X-Men, these things are real and the stakes are high. And Morph was not supposed to come back. But then when you got tapped for the second season, they said, oh, you know, big hit. But we did a focus group with a bunch of 7-year-olds or 9, and we asked them who was their favorite character. And they all said, Morph! So can you bring Morph back? And it's like, oh, man!
And that actually brought Sinister in more heavily, because when we ended the first season, the scripts and the storyboard and even the original animation, there wasn't a little hint of Sinister at the end of episode 13.
Because it was going to be the end of the series.
Because that was just going to be the end of the series. That was just going to be when it finished, and we didn't know if we're going to get more episodes. And then when we got the note from the network saying, look, we really need you to bring Morph back, we said, okay, well, how do we explain his off-screen death? Oh, okay, well, maybe it's a Sinister plot. And that was the seed of building the whole Sinister plot for the second season, was simply a way to explain how it looked like Morph had died, but he hadn't really died. And this is so we probably sat down with Larry and Bob Harris on a phone call maybe and said, okay, we need to reintroduce Morph. Who would be clever enough to have faked his death, and who would have wanted to fake his death? Who could have had a rational reason for faking his death to use him for something, and maybe we can bring him back damaged. Okay, who would do that to him? And so, but Sinister. So it was like, to answer your question, 90% of the time when we introduce somebody new, like Sinister or Apocalypse, or anything, they're all these major players. We wanted to introduce them, but we try to introduce them in relation to one of our main something our main character was going through. With Apocalypse, it was okay. We want to have the most intense rogue story we can tell. Okay, what's the most? Oh, she's going to give up her powers. Who would she give up her powers to?
Who
could possibly believably do this? And who would be behind a fraud version of it? Apocalypse. Okay, cool. So it built the seeds always. What's the most intense story for our character? Mm-hmm. And then as we build it out, oh, this Marvel villain or this Marvel associate would be just be the coolest one to throw up against whoever it is that we're dealing with. Obviously, something like Gambit's background, it had to be the real people from the books. But we picked the one, I think, difference from that is when we wanted to introduce, just to say, oh, we need to meet Nightcrawler. Then mm-hmm. we actually took it and said, okay, where is the most intense Nightcrawler? Okay, it has to be about his faith because that's the main right. thing about him. Okay, that's stage one. So then we went again back to the main cast. Who in the main cast could we make the most dramatic interaction with when we meet this guy for the first time? And it's not going to be Jubilee because she hasn't struggled with faith yet. You know, she's 13. You know, Wolverine has lived 95 years. He's seen a genocide. Mm-hmm. He's been through life. Mm-hmm. He's going to be the one that might struggle with the idea of faith. Mm-hmm. And if this benign, beautiful creature comes up to him and starts spouting the Bible to him, who, you know, nobody else would have been half as interesting to introduce Nightcrawler with than Wolverine there giving him crap. Mm-hmm. And it was always character based. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah. Same thing with Iceman. We thought, okay, here's a character that they know, have some tension between among him and Xavier and Cyclops, mm-hmm. and have this be this father two sons thing going, so that there's a big emotion. It's not just, oh, look at the cool guy that can do ice stuff. Mm-hmm. It's how can we make as dramatic a story about while we introduce this guy, mm-hmm. and you get to know him and he's gone, and then you'll remember him forever. And it won't just be because of the ice. It'll be because of the relationship with Xavier.
I love that. That's a great answer. I hope Nick was taking notes there. He's got his first comic book coming out very soon. Oh, cool. Right here. So as a comic book writer, I hope he was taking notes there. Cause I love that answer.
Yeah. I mean, it makes perfect sense. I mean, we see it with so many of the my favorite comic book writers are too. Everything is so heavily character driven. And honestly, too, when you look at the MCU, it's kind of the same thing. Like a lot of the best stories, the best introductions of characters is through somebody else. I mean, you go back to, mm-hmm. Captain America, Winter Soldier. Obviously, you know, Bucky was previously in the original Captain America movie, but that's how Falcon, who is now Captain America, gets introduced there. We get a little more fleshing out of Black Widow as well. Mm-hmm. But that's like those organic moments where it's like, there, you know, Captain America's walking around in the world, and then it's like, oh, I just met Falcon, and it makes sense because of his background, yeah. too. So yeah, 100%, totally get that.
All right. So last time that we spoke with you, we asked if you were in charge of introducing the X-Men to the MCU, how would you go about doing that? But I have a little bit of a spin on that, okay. if that's okay with you here. Because now as we get closer to that introduction, you know, how do you go about explaining how the MCU general public would be maybe xenophobic of the X-Men when they've welcomed in like all these already enhanced humans of the Avengers?
That is a hard question because that's so much a central part of our show. Mm-hmm. I always, and I don't envy the people doing it. I know it's a huge part of the next 5 to 10 years of the, you know, what Marvel is working away to get the X-Men into this world. And mm-hmm. There's so many variables. It's like juggling 18 plates at once. How do they do it? I don't envy them. But my reaction is think think about Spider-Man, which is obviously a brilliant, huge, immortal character and setup, mm-hmm. and will live forever. I had trouble, even I think as an adolescent, a little bit of trouble thinking they're bending over backwards, making drama for people to dislike this guy. He's really a hero. He never almost does anything wrong. They have to just make up weird mistakes people make and misunderstandings to where people are afraid of him or dislike him or come after him. And yet Spider-Man persists forever. I just, you know, if they're able to do it for this nice teenager who never has hurt a fly, I think they'll be able to manage somehow with the X-Men and keep that, because maybe it'll just be the audiences be able to, you know, not think about the fact that they just cheered Thor on somewhere else and they're bothered by these people in their neighborhood. I don't envy the people having to make that real.
But going back to the original animated series, the opening images are Sabretooth taking on some police officers and some police cars.
Throwing cars.
And it's and you pull back and you realize that you're watching a newscast. So you are instantly introduced to this world where there are humans and there are big scary things out there who will throw cars at police officers. And I'm a human and I can't do that, but other things out there can.
And I'm not quite sure, you know, with the Avengers, it's pretty clear that it's a bunch of big heroes. Mm-hmm. And with the X-Men and some of the other characters, I think it's just not, I think it's hard for the general public to differentiate, okay, is that Wolverine or is that Sabretooth? And what does him walking down the street mean to me? Mm-hmm. You know? So it just, we had to keep enough bad mutants, enough villains,
right,
enough people causing, you know, causing hysteria to keep it real. So it's not just that the average people in the X-Men universe are racist. It's that they've got a reason to be scared.
As you're talking about it, Eric, I'm kind of wondering too, because Wes and I have talked about this subject matter. It's funny, meaning last time we had you on, we asked you about it. But I think now, as you're saying it, where it's like having it be where these are like people you wouldn't necessarily assume have these abilities, they're supposed to be just like you and me, I would think that an easy way to do that is through the school, through the kids, you know. And if you do that with the original X-Men class, you know, of Iceman, Beast, Jean, Cyclops, and Angel, that may be, you know, Angel might be a little bit more on the nose, and Beast, you could work around it. But maybe that's how they end up doing it, is they have these kids who just randomly start to learn while they're in class, and then the parents start losing their minds because, like, my kid's not safe because there's mutants, and who knows who is mutant, who isn't a mutant. Like, that's that's as we're talking about it, it seems like the easiest or maybe the smartest way to do it. I don't know, but I'm coming up with it, so maybe it's not that smart.
No, but also in the original, let's not forget Jubilee's foster parents. Look what she did to the VCR just by touching it. You know, if it's people around you that you thought you knew, and suddenly you're not as safe as you thought you were, that can really knock you off balance. And very interesting. And remember, 30 years ago, Margaret Lesh it was important that people knew who Batman was. People could name Wonder Woman
or Superman or
even Spider-Man. But as far as any of the X-Men 30 years ago, the general audience was not aware. Mm-hmm. Comic population, huge. But that was a much smaller world back then, too. And there was no internet. There was no immediate way to communicate with everybody else about this. So a large part of it was you having to introduce the idea of mutancy.
We were constantly just trying to be clear to she picked the number at 85-90% of the audience not knowing who the X-Men were, mm-hmm. which is a totally different world now.
Yeah.
If a new X-Men movie comes out, you figure that 9 out of 10 people going to this will know the X-Men's history. And so you're going to have to write the stories with that in mind, as opposed to having to spend the first third of the story kind of setting up how mutants and humans are having issues. It'll be more of a shorthand. And I think people have accepted it, have accepted the situation. And I don't know. I'm really curious, because obviously we had this wonderful run of movies, you know, good, mediocre, indifferent, whatever, some of them wonderful, and kind of ending with Logan. And that was as a valedictorian. Just so you know, we were good friends with Len Wein, who created Wolverine.
Len Wein, oh my God.
Who wrote four episodes for us. And he passed a few years ago, yeah. But we were over at his house when the week Logan came out, and he was very, very happy with it. He just thought they really got it.
We may have asked you this on the last time we interviewed, but do you have a favorite live action X-Men movie? Your favorite adaptation?
Yeah, besides Logan.
Okay,
besides Logan. I think that would top everyone's charts there.
It's not necessarily my favorite because it is the best movie, but the thrill of the very first X-Men movie hitting the big screen.
Yeah.
And realizing they chose to use the same team of characters that Eric had pulled for the animated series, mm-hmm. and go, oh my goodness, that was, wow, look at that up there on the big screen.
It was awe-inspiring. Wow. And you see people like Patrick Stewart and the other amazing cast up there. He said, this is, if I had $1 billion, this is what, these are choices I would have made. Yeah. It just was so satisfying. Obviously, it's things we would have done differently. But as far as the other one, there was the one where you first meet the younger X-Men. And I was always curious about that. I love thinking about stories about Xavier and Magneto when they were younger. So when you first, was it Last Stand? Whatever the one was where...
Was it First Class? Look at
First Class. Yeah, with Sebastian Shaw, right?
Yeah, Sebastian Shaw. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I thought... and we talked with the writers on that, and evidently nobody wanted the Magneto character.
Michael Fassbender.
Evidently, the studio said, "Oh, don't pick this guy. No, we can't use this guy. He's terrible."
About
Fassbender?
Yeah. It's just there was evidently serious resistance, and the creative people had to fight and fight and fight till the last minute to get him to be on as Magneto. And there's that amazing scene down in, was Argentina with you know, yeah. And we were talking to the screenwriter, and he said, we went through so many versions of that story, but the one thing that never changed was that Magneto confronting the Germans in Argentina scene. He said that was there from the first till the end, and everything changed around it. But see, I thought the young Xavier was marvelous.
James McAvoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that seeing these new people, it's like watching a whole new interpretation of these people. And we liked like telling some time travel stories, like One Man's Worth, where you meet Xavier when he's 21, mm-hmm. and you mm-hmm. meet these other kids and getting the sense what they're like before they've been through, lived half their life. And that was great fun for me to watch the new young cast play with the characters.
That's amazing. Yeah, the Fassbender note's remarkable because Wes and I have been debating back and forth recently about, you know, between Fassbender and McKellen for who was the better big screen Magneto. But like, you know, that's the character, you know, where that's been cast twice that, you know, knocked out of the park.
At two different stages of their life. It's like the perfect iteration of Eric there at that point. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's wild. But then and then of course, like, you know, they're kind of maybe not at that tier. If they are, it's like right below of like the all time casting that we've seen in superhero movies. And of course, two other individuals have been Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool and then Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. And we were talking a little bit before the show about the recent trailer that we got. Obviously, we're mm-hmm. a few months away from Deadpool and Wolverine. I'm curious for you two, is there anything specifically that you're hoping for from that movie?
Just as I often say, just the electric thrill of watching it happen. It's just, Deadpool has been so delightfully irreverent, you know, but authentic to the character. And one of these, oh my God, what am I seeing? Oh my God, I can't stop laughing. Oh my God, kind of iterations on the big screen.
Yeah, I thought I didn't know what quite to expect from a Deadpool movie, and it was so perfect.
Yeah,
we couldn't believe it. In fact, it came out. We were in the middle of writing the show, maybe about episode about just beginning the third season of writing the show, and we went to Marvel that in the summer after we'd finished writing the second.
This is like
95, I think. Yeah, 94, summer of 94 maybe. And the Marvel was talking to us, okay, we've done 26 episodes. The network is committed to 39 more. Yay! Let's actually get together in person and talk about what some new ones you might want to, you know, some stuff you might want to do, because they hadn't really been that suggestive before. We just, the first 26 were pretty much stuff we came up with that were either pitched to us by writers or the one thing we, they're pretty much original stories. We said, okay, well, now that we know that this is a successful show, let's sit down with Marvel and mine their best stuff. And that's where we start, you know, with the Phoenix Saga, whatever. But we're there and they suggest all these different characters to use. Okay, Mojo and this guy. Okay, and be sure to use Nightcrawler. You haven't used Nightcrawler yet. But then one of the guys there at the office, Marvel office, said, oh, we got this new guy here. Have a couple copies. It was Deadpool. There was issue one of Deadpool. He said, have a look at this comic. I don't think he's going to fit in your show, but enjoy it. We just, you know, it's a kind of a different take on superheroes. Okay, cool. Put it in a file. Didn't look at it for 30 years.
Larry Houston did, though, because he makes that's Deadpool right. makes a
and that's why Larry put a cameo of Deadpool in whatever that was, with one of the Phoenix Saga. You know, he's there. But that was this Marvel saying, okay, we're trying this new guy. I hope you enjoy him. And now he's become this, you know, Ryan Reynolds has turned him, has made him permanent for us.
It's wild. I would actually love to, as we're talking through this, I would love to see, as he's like jumping around, it's like it seems going to be in different universes, I would love to see him pop up in the animated universe on the big screen with your same animation style. That would be really cool. But as we wrap this up, we have one question that we wanted to ask you. So we know now, of course, you know, season two is progressing. We've heard, you know, that season three has already been greenlit as well, which is amazing. What is the message or experience that you two are hoping that viewers take away from X-Men 97, whether they're people like Wes and I who have been watching the show since we were old enough to watch the show, or people who are just getting into it for the first time?
Well, this is kind of an oblique way to look at it, but I would encourage anyone who finds something that he or she or they like or love, just love it, just like it, let it, hold on to it. You know, don't let anyone tell you not to. Don't let anyone say, oh, yikes. If you find something that matters to you, that matters to you. And here we are 30 years later talking about a show that we worked very hard on, but we had no idea what the reception was going to be like. And for a couple of decades, we didn't know what the audience...
If it would just ever be remembered at all. I mean, it's, you know, we worked on 50 different shows, and this is the one all the magic happened for reasons we have no control over and no idea how to duplicate. I mean, it just was... So as far as the new show goes... You know, I think it comes back to the characters and you know you forever you keep characters that somehow you fell in love with. If you're a little kid and you read Sherlock Holmes, well, when you're 75, if there's a new Sherlock Holmes movie, you're gonna get into it because you know why you fell for that character in the first place, and you don't want him to be wrong, but you want to see him do something a little fresh, a little new, or a little surprising, and then come back to be the guy that you wanted. So, we didn't feel like we were loading our show with messages, or we're just trying to tell some good heroic stories with characters we loved and respected, and out of that. And out of the basic setup that Stan and Jack Kirby gave us of these people being, you know, different. I mean, that was such a perfect starting point for all these hundreds of stories, these 60 years of comics and all the different movies and TVs. It's just this whole situation where you understand the people that are different and what, you know, it's a great starting point. And it's so much, you know, social discussion and so many themes can come out of it, but it's better than it was a really great gift for us for the storytelling, because you can't deny that these people are something different, yet you have to decide whether you accept them or not. And that internal tension will fuel these stories forever.
And the fact that you tend to discover or learn or realize that you have one of these kind of latent mutations when you hit adolescence puberty. I mean, that's enough of a mind mess as a young person anyway. And then, so I think it's a brilliant metaphor for anyone who's old enough to go through that, or sees and realize this is just how I am. But, oh, wait, those people don't like me just because of this. I mean, that's made for brilliant storytelling.
And relatability, too. Like you said, everyone goes through it there, too. Absolutely. Yeah. Eric and Julia, thank you so much for the time here. We hope you enjoy the rest of X-Men 97 as much as we do here. Of course, episode 7 is coming out as a crow flies in 2 days, Wednesday, April 24th. So, 3-4 episodes left there. I think there's a 3-parter, if I'm not mistaken, that closes out the season.
Yeah,
that's the last three pretty much are pretty tight together, and I think they're going to show the last two the same day.
Well, we don't know that
because the first schedule we saw had 9 and 10 being dropped on the same day.
The other schedule I saw didn't have.
That. Yeah. So
maybe there's a dummy schedule getting tossed around there.
We don't know. Yeah, we don't know, but that's to the best of our knowledge. So,
Well, one last question: was there any discussion about having the show air on Saturday?
And was there any discussion about having a tie-in with Pizza Hut?
And that would be a good win. Yeah.
Both of those conversations have taken place more than once. And for whatever reasons, the powers that be releasing it at 12:01 Wednesday morning, I guess that's what the algorithms have told them is the best place to do it. But boy, that makes waking up Wednesday morning a bit stressful. You go, oh my God, the episode.
If I had to watch episode 6 at 6 a.m., you know, that would be a tough way to start the day there.
And it's rough because I do see folks saying, okay, I've already watched it, but I'm going to sit down on Saturday morning with my bowl of cereal and watch it again. I like that.
You're right. We can control that there, right?
That's true.
With Disney Plus there, we can watch it whenever we want to watch it at that point.
You just got to stay on the social media.
Yeah, bingo. Eric and Julia, thank you so much for the time. We love having you. Hopefully we can come back, maybe discuss season 2, season 3, season 4, season 5. You know, who knows?
From
your lips to Apocalypse's ears.
If they'll have us, we're on for the long haul. We can't wait to see what they come up with.